Well, it is good to be with you this morning, and I don't have the kind of voice that carries a long way. I wish I did. So if you can't hear me at any point, just give me something like this so I can remember to project. There was a handout yesterday, and maybe there's more of them. There's a little bit about what we'll be talking about this morning there, but let me just remind us what we have been talking about starting yesterday to bring everybody up to speed here. We're thinking about biblical theology, and biblical theology is trying to figure out the theology of the Bible. So it's not mysteriously named. That's pretty much what it is, the theology of the Bible. But in particular, what we do in biblical theology is we think about how a theme develops across the contours of redemptive history. And let me tell you what I mean by that. The Bible comes to us not as an assorted collection of God stuff. It's not an anthology of godly advice. It comes to us as a story. And when I say story, I don't mean a false story. I mean, it is a true story, but it's got a beginning, it's got a plot line, and it's got a consummation. And I said yesterday that the scriptures teach this redemptive story, story of redemption, story of salvation. It does this in four significant acts. The first act is creation. That's Genesis 1 and 2. And then there's the fall. That's Genesis 3, where sin enters the world. And then from Genesis 3 onward, there's a plan that is put into place to redeem humanity. And that's Act 3. And that takes you from Genesis 3 all the way through the Old Testament, through the Gospels, up to pretty much the book of Revelation. And then the book of Revelation, there's some other prophecies assorted throughout the Bible as well, speaks of the consummation or the restoration, the eternal state. And that's really the storyline of the Bible. And there's different book orders around the world. The Jewish Old Testament is in a different order than what we usually have in our Bibles. But that doesn't change the story at all. It doesn't change the story at all. So creation, fall, redemption, and consummation. And what I also tried to show yesterday, and what I'll try to prove in the sermon later this morning, is that here's the story, but the star of the story is Jesus Christ. And our task when we're reading the scriptures is, of course, to read it in context. We want to read every single verse of the Bible in context. And you know, that might seem obvious until you've gone to a Bible study before and you hear all sorts of weird observations where people do with the Bible what they would never do with the ordinary speech that we encounter. Everybody, as far as I know, wants to be taken in context. How many of you have ever said something and then been taken out of context? Raise your hands high if that has ever happened. How many of you liked it? No one likes being taken out of context. I've never heard anyone who said, man, I was talking to Joe yesterday, I was telling this one story, and then he went and told someone else, took me totally out of context. It was awesome. It was awesome. It was so good. No, nobody likes being taken out of context. It's so intuitively obvious that context determines meaning that maybe you've noticed that every time a celebrity, like an actor or a sports figure or a politician, says something really stupid, which happens often, and it's publicized, and instead of just owning it and saying, I am so sorry, I'm a wretched sinner, and I said something dumb and offensive, please forgive me, they say, I was taken out of context. That is the go-to. Now, why do they say that? Because everyone knows that context determines meaning. Everyone knows that. And so until we open up our Bibles And then it feels like we have free rein to do whatever we want with these divine words, including taking the Lord and the biblical authors out of context. I suspect that the Lord enjoys being taken out of context even less than you do. Even less than you do. So, one of the things that we do in biblical theology is we try to figure out how any particular passage or verse contributes to the whole. In biblical theology, we're saying the context, the broadest context of any individual passage, any individual verse, is the story. And if Jesus Christ is the star of the story, that if the Bible is telling this plan of redemption, this story of redemption, where God is going to step in and do for us what we could not do for ourselves, that is, reconcile us to God, save us from sin, save us from God, save us from ourselves, the only one who can do that is the Lord. And the Bible tells the story of that. Now, and of course, Jesus is the star. And so every single passage in the Bible contributes in a significant way, some more significant than others, of course, in a significant way to telling the story of Jesus. Every passage contributes in a significant way to preparing or telling this story. Now, there's a lot of background, obviously, because Jesus doesn't show up on the scene until the New Testament, right, in Matthew. So we have this whole Old Testament. And the Old Testament does many things, but one of the most significant things, and I think the most significant thing, is it prepares us for the Messiah. It prepares us for the coming of Jesus. So what I want to do then, now, is I want to model for you just the reading of a story in the Bible. And again, when I say story, I don't mean like made up fable. I mean a true story, a true story. I want to model for you the reading of a story. And when I was a young child, I don't know why I said that. Could have just said child. All children are young, right? When I was a child, my favorite Bible story was David and Goliath. And I grew up in the era of flannel board Jesus. Anybody remember that? Where you put the little like things in the arms, the one-dimensional, and they could move up and down. And I remember my mom would teach Sunday school, and she would get the curriculum, and she would cut out all of the figures, and that was so exciting. And they put the little, I don't know what it was called, the some sort of pin in the arms, and David could do the sling. It's all in like just two-dimensional. You stick it up on the board, and then David, you know, this, well, anyway. So exciting, super exciting. And then I got to college, and I thought, man, I'm really maturing in the Lord here. But if you would have asked me what my favorite Bible story was, I would have said David and Goliath. And then I went away to seminary, and I did that for a while, and I got some degrees, and now I teach at a seminary. And if you ask me what is your favorite Bible story, I will tell you it is David and Goliath. I think it's the most fun story in the Bible. And so let's go look at that. I titled this kind of facetiously 1 Samuel 17, Little People Can Do Big Things Too? ? Or Something More. Now, 1 Samuel 17 tells the story of David and Goliath. And something you heard me say yesterday a lot too, if you were here, was the biblical authors are really good writers. They are very good writers. They know how to tell a good story. And because every word is inspired by the Holy Spirit, every word is the word of God. We should have confidence that every word is significant. It is contributing to this story. But whoever wrote 1 Samuel, and I take it probably wasn't Samuel. It might have been, but 1 and 2 Samuel go long beyond the death of Samuel. So it'd be kind of weird if he was writing it out, including the story of his death and such. But whoever wrote it, this 1 Samuel 17, does not assume that you just picked up your Bible and started in 1 Samuel 17, right? Nobody writes a story like that. They assume that you've been with them from the beginning. And so the author of 1 Samuel has been preparing us for this David and Goliath story from the very beginning of 1 Samuel. In fact, we could even go further back and say the biblical authors, whoever wrote 1 Samuel 17, doesn't just assume that you've already read 1 Samuel 1 through 16, but you've actually read Genesis all the way up to this point, because that's the broader context of this story. Now, so let's think about what that broader context is. We have a creation where humans, Adam and Eve, are made in the image of God. God has created these little images of himself to represent him. God is the creator. That means he has creator's rights over everything. He's the Lord of everything that exists because he made it all. And he creates these little representatives and says, be fruitful and multiply, which is a pretty remarkable thing, because God made two images of himself, and he gives to us the responsibility and privilege of procreating other images of the living God, which is an amazing, awesome responsibility. And then he says, exercise dominion over this, which my translation of that is take care of all my stuff. Take care of all my stuff. And so he has these little vice regents, these little authority figures representing him, and they, in Genesis 3, they rebel against God. They rebel against God. And the problem with this is now they're separated from God. They have received a death sentence, and they're also separated from each other. And even from themselves. Because you notice, what is the very first thing that Adam and Eve do when they sin? What's that?
They hide
from God, but they hide from each other as well, because they make clothing, leaves, to cover themselves from each other. They're in bed. Like, isn't it weird? The very first implication of sin is body shame. They're embarrassed, and they are ashamed. They're ashamed of themselves. They're ashamed of each other. So there's conflict within each individual. There's conflict between individuals, and there's conflict with God. And then God comes, and he does some cursing of the serpent, of the woman, of the man. But he tells the serpent that one day I'm going to raise up a serpent crusher, and it's going to come from this woman that you deceived. She's going to be the one who's responsible for your undoing. And so God has this plan. He announces it in Genesis 3:15. There's going to be a baby born who's going to redeem, who's going to crush the serpent. And then we move along through the rest of the Old Testament, and it's kind of a quest for this baby. Is this the special baby? Is this the special baby? Is this the special baby? And the answer every time is like, no, no. We get our hopes up at times, but no. No, it's not. No, it's not. God works through a man, Abraham. Then he works through Abraham's family. Each time there's a significant covenant made, first with Abraham and then with Israel. There's rules about how to represent God and how to live before him. And there's also promises made. There's a promise made to one of Abraham's grandsons, Jacob, that from one of his boys, Judah, is going to come a line of kings. A line of kings. And so we're thinking, man, is this going to be the special baby? Is this going to be the special baby? But when Israel first becomes a nation, they don't have a king. And there's chaos, as you know, if you've read the book of Judges. And the last of the judges, these leaders that God raises up to rescue Israel, the last of the judges is a man named Samuel. And Samuel is kind of a pivot point for how God interacts with his people, because he's the last judge and really the first prophet as well. And to Samuel is given the responsibility of anointing the first king. And that's where we'll pick up our story here. In 1 Samuel chapter 8, and again, mind you, we're coming off of the book of Judges where there's chaos. And we're still in the era of the judges, because Samuel is judging Israel. And Samuel is a really good guy, but he's not a very good dad. And his sons don't measure up at all. His sons are scoundrels. And so it's pretty obvious that there's no line of Samuel that's going to continue to govern Israel. And so the people begin to ask for a king. If you turn to 1 Samuel chapter 8, verses 19 and 20, this is where we run into the request. But the people refused to obey the voice of Samuel. And they said, "No, but there shall be a king over us, that we also may be like all the nations, and that our king may judge us and go out before us and fight our battles." So they go to Samuel and say, "We want a king." And what's their rationale for it? Why do they want one?
Everybody else has got one.
So we can be like all the nations that surround us. And if you've been reading in your Bibles up to this point, you should just groan at this. Because if there was one thing that Israel was not to be, it was like the other nations. God had given them a law full of all sorts of ceremony and food laws and clothing laws and how to cut your hair and how to talk for the express purpose of you will not be like the other nations. You will not be like the other nations. You will not be like the other nations. And so when the people of Israel say, "We want a king so we can be like all the other nations." And everybody's like, "Yeah, that's a great idea." But we as Bible readers, we should go, "That is not a good idea. That is a terrible idea, terrible idea." And yet they want one. And Samuel's bummed about this because he thinks that they're asking for a king. That's a terrible idea. And they're basically rejecting me. And then God ends up telling him, he says, "Samuel, don't feel bad. They have rejected you, but they're not really rejecting you as king. They're rejecting me. They're rejecting me as king." But another thing that the Israelites said when they were requesting a king, not only do they want someone who will be like, so they can be like all the other nations, but they want someone who will go out and lead them into battle. Someone who will go out and lead them into battle. And in chapter 9, verse 16, we find that this is what God gives them. Was it the great theologian Garth Brooks who said that some of God's greatest blessings are unanswered prayers? Well, this is where God answers their prayer, and it's a curse, right? It's a curse. So in chapter 9, verse 16, we read this: "Tomorrow about this time," this is the Lord talking to Samuel, "tomorrow about this time, I will send to you a man from the land of Benjamin, and you shall anoint him to be prince over my people Israel. He shall save my people from the hand of the Philistines, for I've seen my people because their cry has come to me." And then in chapter 10, verse 1, "Then Samuel took a flask of oil and poured it on his," and this is Saul's head, "and kissed him and said, 'Has not the Lord anointed you to be prince over his people Israel? And you shall reign over the people of the land, Lord, and you will save them from the hand of their surrounding enemies.'" And then he goes on from there. So now there's many responsibilities to be king, but what the biblical authors are telling us in this story, what's the number one job description? What does a king have to do? It's the only thing they even say that the king's going to do. What's their responsibility? Fight. Fight the Lord's enemies. Lead them into battle and save the people of Israel. God is going to save Israel through the king, just like he had saved Israel time and time and time again through the judge. Now, again, there's lots of responsibilities to be king, but the biblical authors are telling us this is the number one responsibility. As a matter, it's so number one. It's the only one they even mention. It's the only one they mention. And that sets us up. Now, Saul, okay, we should be thinking here as we're reading along, because we're reading in the context of the whole Bible. As we're reading along, when Samuel anoints Saul, when God says, "Take Saul," we should be thinking, this is not going to work. Why?
He's not of Judah.
He's not from the line of Judah. And the great king who is to come is supposed to be a lion from the tribe of Judah. There's a scepter that will never depart from this king that's raised up from Judah. Saul, on the other hand, is a, what tribe? Benjaminite. Now, if you've been reading through up to this point, The tribe of Benjamin, good guys or bad guys?
Bad
guys. There's a horrific story at the very end of the book of Judges that tells you just what creeps the tribe of Benjamin are. And there's civil war that breaks out, and Benjamin is almost wiped out, and then there's this weird story about how like the women are all dead, and they have to repopulate, and so they go up to Jabesh Gilead to get more women, and they bring them back, and it sounds a little bit like Seven Brides for Seven Brothers.
Yeah.
It's very strange. But anyway, so and then the tribe of Benjamin is kind of repopulated because they went to Jabesh Gilead and got some ladies. And that's if that sounds weird to you, you're reading well. Okay, so Saul is from the tribe of Benjamin. He doesn't come with great pedigree, but he is eye candy. He looks the part. He's taller than everyone. He is more handsome than everyone. This is someone that the people can look at and be proud of. God gives them exactly what they want. God gives them, if you will, a man after their heart. Man after their heart. And with Saul, we're introduced to this idea that what you look like, that matters. It mattered to the people of Israel, so God gave it to them. And Saul's a bit of a mixed bag. He does some things that are really good, and then he fails catastrophically as well. At first, he does a good job. When he hears that Jabesh Gilead is in trouble, he rallies these 12 disparate, dysfunctional tribes, unites them under himself, and they go and they rescue their people in Jabesh Gilead. Now, Saul probably had some other motivation for rescuing them because they're family, right? Their family. But he goes and rescues them and unites Israel under one king. They are now like a real nation. 12 tribes united under one king. He's doing a good job. The Spirit of the Lord is on him and it's working well. But then, as you know, Saul blows it. We see this in chapter 13, verse 14. Saul goes out to fight, and he ends up disobeying. Now, what was Saul's sin? Do you all remember? There's two things in particular that Saul did.
He usurped the prophet authority. He was doing sacrifices.
That's right.
He refused to wait for Samuel.
That's right. He offered illegitimate sacrifice, not waiting for the man designated by God. He kind of took things into his own hands and did that. And he also disobeyed the Lord by not destroying one of the nations that God was judging. And it's a rather comical thing because Samuel finally shows up and Saul, because King Saul had been told, destroy every living creature, including the animals. Wipe them off the face of the earth. And of course, he holds back some of the animals and spares the life of the king. And Samuel shows up and Saul comes out to greet him. Hey, Samuel, you're here. And Samuel's like, what? I can't hear you. I said, it's good that you're here. Samuel's like, I can't hear you. It's good that I can't hear you over the bleeding of all these animals that you were supposed to kill. And so in verse 14 of chapter 13, you get this judgment of the Lord. But now your kingdom shall not continue. The Lord has sought out a man after his own heart. And the Lord has commanded him to be prince over his people because you have not kept what the Lord has commanded you. And so God is going to select now a person after his own heart. He gave to Israel a man after their heart. Now God's going to give them a man after his own heart. And so we still haven't gotten to 1 Samuel 17. And it's 9:35. So here, we get to 1 Samuel 16. And this is where David is anointed king. David is from the tribe of Judah. So we're thinking, this might work. He's from the tribe of Judah. And he's from Bethlehem, even. Anybody know what the word Bethlehem means in Hebrew? Bethlehem? House of bread. House of bread. That's going to be kind of important as we move along here as well. And so Samuel is supposed to go up and anoint this man, that he doesn't know who it is to be king. God just says, go to the house of Jesse, and I will show you who the next king of Israel is going to be. And so he goes there and greets Jesse, and Jesse, where are your boys? Where are your boys? Will you go get them? And they come in like descending order, oldest first. And the first one is Eliab, and he's eye candy too. He looks the part. And Samuel, the prophet of the Lord, says, surely this is the Lord's, what? Anointed. What's the Hebrew term for anointed one?
Messiah.
Literally, that's what it says. Surely this is the Lord's Messiah. Surely this is him. And God says, no, it's not. When they came, he looked on Eliab and thought, surely the Lord's anointed, the Lord's Messiah is before him. Verse 7, chapter 16. But the Lord said to Samuel, do not look on his appearance or on the height of his stature, because I have rejected him. For the Lord sees not as man sees. Man looks on the outward appearance, but the Lord looks on the heart. Samuel should have understood that because of the failure that King Saul was, right? So here the prophet of the Lord has to be reminded, man looks on the outward appearance, but the Lord looks on the heart. And I think if this were like a Greek chorus, that line should just be repeated over and over again. Man looks on the outward appearance, but the Lord looks on the heart. This sets us up for 1 Samuel 17, what is to come. Now, so they go down through the whole line, however many brothers there were, and they finally get to David. David wasn't even invited. He's so insignificant. He's so not what you would expect a king to look like, that they don't even invite him. But Samuel knows it's got to be a son of Jesse. Is this all you got? Oh, there's one more, little David. Well, go get him. Go get him. And so David shows up, and the Lord says, this is the guy. This is the guy. And so he anoints him, we're told. Verse 18. Then Samuel took the horn of oil and anointed him, christened him in the Greek, christened him, or messiahed him, in the midst of his brothers, and the Spirit of the Lord rushed upon David from that day forward. From that day forward. So, two things we should remember. We're set up now for 1 Samuel 17. One, man looks at the outward appearance, but the Lord looks at the heart. Two, this David, who is a man after God's own heart, is full of the Spirit. Full of the Spirit. Also, we're told that right after the Spirit came upon David, the Spirit departed from Saul. And that's not going to go well. And then the rest plays out. So let's just read the story of David and Goliath now. And I'll make a few comments, and that will be that for this. Okay. Now the Philistines gathered their armies for battle, and they were gathered at Soko, which belongs to Judah, and encamped between Soko and Azekah in Ephes Damim. And Saul and the men of Israel were gathered and encamped in the valley of Elah and drew up in line of battle against the Philistines. Okay, so what's going on here was something that was very common. The Philistines lived basically where all the citizens of Israel live today. They live in on the coast of the Mediterranean. They live on the beach. And they were mighty workers of iron. As it turns out, this is borne out through all of 1 Samuel. They had weapons and they had chariots. But what they didn't like to do is they didn't like to farm. The Israelites were really good farmers. And so whenever it was harvest season, the Philistines would gather for battle, take their chariots in, and they would attack and dominate and take all the food that was being harvested by the Israelites. And this repeated itself over and over again. And one of the jobs of the leaders of Israel is, we got to stop this from happening. And so this is what's happening here. The Philistines are lined up for battle, and there is something called the Bethlehem Ridge Route, where that you enter it through the Elah Valley, and it takes you on this ridge route right to Bethlehem, which is the house of bread. We know, if you've read the book of Ruth, you know there's all this grain harvest and such that's there. And so King Saul has gathered the armies of Israel, and they are determined to stop the Philistines from going up the Bethlehem Ridge route straight into the area of Bethlehem to protect their food stores. That's what's going on here. And they're encamped on either side of the valley with the Israelites trying to defend this ridge route. And they're at a bit of a stalemate, because what the Philistines want to do is they want to take their chariots on a nice road and they can just dominate the Israelites. The Israelites are not interested in going onto the plain, fighting them on the low ground, and so they're on either side of this valley. No one wants to go into the valley to fight. Well, the Israelites don't want to. The Philistines are trying to lure them down so they can crush them with their chariots. So that's a little bit of what's going on. Okay, verse 3. The Philistines, I gotta get my glasses out, I'm sorry. And the Philistines stood on the mountain on one side, and Israel stood on the mountain on the other side with a valley between them. And there came out from the camp of the Philistines a champion named Goliath of Gath, whose height was 6 cubits and a span. That is really, really tall. It's about 9 feet tall. Now, there are lots of bad guys in the Bible. Israel fights a lot of bad guys. We're not told what any of them look like, but we're told what Goliath looks like, aren't we? We're given incredible detail. Now, why would that be? Because man looks on the outward appearance, but the Lord looks at the heart. We're set up for what's about to happen. There came out from the camp of the Philistines a champion named Goliath of Gath. He's 9 feet tall. Would you just look at him? Look at him. He had a helmet of bronze on his head, and he was armed with a coat of mail, and the weight of the coat was 5,000 shekels of bronze. This is an enormous weight. Look at this dude. He had a bronze armor on his legs and a javelin of bronze slung between his shoulders. Look at this guy. Who can fight him? And he had the shaft of his spear was like a weaver's beam, and his spear's head weighed 600 shekels of iron. I think that's 15 pounds. 15 pounds. Look at that. Can you imagine the damage that would do? He stood and shouted to the ranks. Oh, his shield bearer's there before him. It's like the mouth of Sauron here. He stood and shouted to the ranks of Israel, "Why have you come out to drop for battle? Am I not a Philistine, and are you not servants of Saul? Choose a man for yourselves and let him come down to me. If he is able to fight with me and kill me, then we will be your servants. But if I prevail against him and kill him, then you shall be our servants and serve us." So the challenge has been given. The challenge has been given. And this is a way just to instigate the battle, to initiate the battle. And then verse 10, the Philistine said, "I defy the ranks of Israel this day. Give me a man that we may fight together." Okay, who's supposed to go fight Goliath? It's his only job.
The king.
The king, King Saul. But verse 11, when Saul and all Israel heard these words of the Philistine, they were dismayed and greatly afraid. Saul basically soils his armor at this point. He is so afraid. But he's the one who's supposed to go fight. He's basically abdicating his king. Now it gets worse. Now David was a son of an Ephrathite of Bethlehem in Judah named Jesse, who had 8 sons. In the days of Saul, the man was already old and advanced in years. The 3 oldest sons of Jesse had followed Saul to the battle, and why not? They're basically defending their home. The names of the 3 sons who went to battle were Eliab the firstborn, and next to him Abinadab, and the 3rd Shammah. David was the youngest. 3 eldest followed Saul. David went back and forth from Saul to feed his father's sheep at Bethlehem. For 40 days the Philistine came forward and took his stand morning and evening. 40 days. You heard that number before? 40 days and night. 40 days. 40. Jesse. So for 40 days the giant is going out and issuing this challenge, blaspheming God, mocking the people of Israel, and no one answers. No one answers the call. Jesse said to David, his son, "Hey, take your brother some food, see how things are going with them." Verse 19, Saul and they and all the men of Israel were in the Valley of Elah fighting with the Philistines, except they're not really fighting. And David rose early in the morning and left the sheep with the keeper and took the provisions and went as Jesse had commanded him. And he came to the encampment as the host was going out to the battle line, shouting the war cry. It's like everybody gets like super fired up, but nobody does anything. It's like a junior high dance, right? With boys on one side, girls on the other. Everybody's really fired up, and no one does anything. No one does anything. David They're shouting the war cry, though. Israel and the Philistines drew up for battle, army against army. And David left the things in charge of the keeper, the baggage, ran to the ranks, and went and greeted his brothers. As he talked with them, behold, the champion, the Philistine of Gath, Goliath by name, came up out of the ranks of the Philistines and spoke the same words as before. And David heard him. David heard the taunting of Goliath. And who is David? He's a man after God's own heart. He's a man after God's own heart. All the men of Israel, when they saw the man, fled from him and were much afraid. And the men of Israel said, "Have you seen this man who has come up?" Man looks on the outward appearance, but the Lord looks on the heart. Surely he has come up to defy Israel, and the king will enrich the man who kills him with great riches and will give him his daughter and make his father's house free in Israel. This is how pathetic Saul has gotten. He's trying to bribe someone, anyone, to do his job for him. At this point, David, though, hears this. Whoa, this sounds good. What do I get? David said to the men who stood by him, "What shall be done for the man who kills this Philistine and takes away the reproach from Israel?" So you begin to hear David's motivation in this. Yeah, he gets some stuff, but who's going to stand up for the honor of Israel and Israel's God? "For who is this uncircumcised Philistine that he should defy the armies of the living God?" And the people answered him in the same way, "So shall it be done to the man who kills him." So Eliab, who himself is too afraid to go out there, makes fun of David and criticizes him. And David's like, "Man, come on, don't be mean to me. What have I done? I'm just talking." When the words that David spoke were heard, they repeated them before Saul, and he's different. So here this one little kid shows up. I don't know how old he is. He's probably a teenager, right? And he's not like five. But no one is saying anything at all, to the extent that when someone finally says something, it makes its way to Saul. And Saul's like desperate at this point because he's been trying to bribe people for 40 days to do his job for him. And now someone is finally saying something that sounds like, maybe I can get this person to go out and fight him. David said to Saul, "Let no man's heart fail because of him. Your servant will go and fight with this Philistine." Saul said to David, here's my translation, "Look at you. Look at him. Look at you. Look at him. Look at you. You can't do it." Remember, though, man looks on the outward appearance, but the Lord looks on the heart. You're not able to go against this Philistine and fight with him, for you're a youth, and he's been a man of war from his youth. David said to Saul, "Your servant used to keep sheep for his father, and when there came a lion or a bear and took a lamb from the flock, I went after him and struck him and delivered it out of his mouth. And if he arose against me, I caught him by his beard and struck him and killed him. Your servant has struck down both lions and bears, and this uncircumcised Philistine shall be like one of them. Why? He has defied the armies of the living God." And David, who is a man after God's own heart, knows that when you defy the armies of the living God, you are defying God himself, and you cannot live. You cannot live. David said, "The Lord who delivered me from the paw of the lion and from the paw of the bear will deliver me from the hand of this Philistine." We're starting to see David is a man after God's own heart, isn't he? He's the only one who believes. He's the only one who knows that God will fight through him, that God will not be mocked. And if there's a champion that God will work through, God will deliver. And this is enough for Saul. Great, go, go. Then Saul clothed David with his armor. I don't know what Saul was thinking. Maybe if I put my armor on him, people will think that it's me. Because man looks on the outward appearance, but the Lord looks on the heart. He put a helmet of bronze on his head and clothed him with a coat of mail, and David strapped his sword over his arm, and he tried in vain to go, for he had not tested them. They don't fit. David's too little for this. David said to Saul, "I can't go with these. I haven't tested them. I'm not used to this." So David took them off. Then he took his staff in his hand and chose five smooth stones from the brook and put them in a shepherd's pouch. His sling was in his hand, and he approached the Philistine. And I don't know if you've ever been to Israel before, but if you go to the Elah Valley, you can see the place of this fight. And what's really cool is that when I was there, I got the five stones. I got five stones from the Valley of Elah. And so if you go, you can get five stones, but they won't be these stones because I already have these five stones. At least that's what the guy who sold them to me told me. So David goes with his sling, he approached the Philistine. The Philistine moved forward and came near to David with his shield bearer in front of him. And when the Philistine looked and saw David, he disdained him. So again, notice the emphasis on what people see. Here's the mighty giant Goliath, and he sees this little guy who doesn't look anything like a champion, and it's like, this is your champion? Man looks at the outward appearance, but the Lord looks at the heart. Because what Goliath doesn't know is this is David. The David. This is perhaps the greatest figure in all of the Bible except for Jesus Christ himself. It is the King, the true anointed King who is approaching him. David's a youth, ruddy, handsome. He's pretty, too pretty to fight a giant. The Philistine said to David, am I a dog that you come to me with sticks? And the Philistine cursed David by his gods. Ah, so now we know what's really going on here. This isn't just a big dude against a little guy. This is the demonic gods versus the one true God. That's what's taking place here. The Philistine said to David, come to me and I will give your flesh to the birds of the air, to the beasts of the field. Then David said to the Philistine, and this is awesome. You're going to see why David is a man after God's own heart. You come to me with a sword and with a spear and with a javelin, but I come to you in the name of the Lord of hosts. Lord of hosts, that's God's fighting name. The God of the armies of Israel, whom you have defied. And then he engages in a little like holy trash talking. This day the Lord will deliver you into my hand, and I will strike you down and cut off your head. And I will give the dead bodies of the host of the Philistines this day to the birds of the air and to the wild beasts of the earth. Why? So that all the earth may know that there is a God in Israel. Amen. David is demonstrating his kingly worth right here. But in so doing, he's not just any old king, because then he's going to say something else that shows us what kind of king he actually is. It's almost as if he's yelling out to the Philistines, I am going to destroy this man, and then the armies of Israel will destroy you because you have mocked God, and all the world will hear about what I'm going to do on this day, and they will know that there is a God in Israel. And then it's almost as if he turns and addresses the quaking Israelites who are behind him and says, and so that all this assembly, all of you, may know that the Lord saves not with sword and spear, for the battle is the Lord, and he will give you into our hand. What kind of king is David? He's a warrior king, but he's a shepherd king too, because he is pastoring the hearts of the people of Israel at this point. And now it's basically done. Goliath is dead man walking, as far as David is concerned. The Philistine arose and came and drew near to meet David. David ran quickly toward the battle line to meet the Philistine. And David put his hand in his bag and took out a stone and slung it and struck the Philistine on his forehead. The stone sank into his forehead and he fell on his face to the ground. Prostrate before David, prostrate before the God of Israel. And then it's just mop up at this point. David prevailed over the Philistine with a sling and with a stone and struck the Philistine and killed him. There was no sword in David's hand. So all this assembly will know that God doesn't save with those things. David ran, stood over the Philistine, took his sword, drew it out of its sheath, killed him, and cut off his head with it. When the Philistines saw that their champion was dead, they fled. They ran away. Run away, run away. And the men of Israel and Judah rose with a shout and pursued. So they found their courage, right? It's like they're all quaking, and then all of a sudden, yeah! And then they chase after them. The people of Israel came back from chasing the Philistines. They pursued the Philistines as far as Gath and the gates of Ekron, two of the five major Philistine cities. So the wounded Philistines fell on the way from Sha'arim as far as Gath and Ekron. The people of Israel came back from chasing the Philistines. They plundered their camp, and David took the head of the Philistine, brought it to Jerusalem. but he put his armor in his tent. And then, and it goes on from there. Okay, so there's the story. So I'm thinking about this from biblical theology, and I read the story in like its broader context. But here I want to point out how this points us to Jesus, and it does so in a couple ways. One, David becomes the king that's going to shepherd Israel. Israel becomes this nation that ensures the prolongation of Israel, so that eventually Jesus could come. Right, so that's important here. But David is also significant because, as the New Testament makes clear, Jesus Christ is the son of David. David is what we would call a type of Christ. Now how would I show that? Let me ask you this. King Saul was anointed king. Was Saul a Messiah of the Lord? Yes or no? Well, yes, he was. He was anointed king. He's the anointed one. Remember David refused to raise his hand against Saul. He said, I will not raise my hand against the Lord's Messiah. Against the Lord's Messiah. Saul was a Messiah. But was he the Messiah? Okay, now you can say no. No, he was not. David. Was David a Messiah? Yes, he was. Was he the Messiah? No. But he is so close. He's so close that when the real Messiah shows up, we'll recognize him because he looks like David. How does he look like David? Well, just from what we're told here, he's a man after God's own heart. The author of the book of Hebrews tells us that Jesus Christ is the radiance of God's glory. Right? He absolutely is a man after God's own heart. The Spirit of God rushed upon David even as it departed from Saul. And David, we're told, it rushed upon David from that day forward. But Jesus Christ, according to the Gospel of John, is the one who possessed the Spirit without measure. Jesus is the Spirit-anointed man. David, as we know, he was motivated by the glory of God. Who is this uncircumcised Philistine that he should defy the armies of the living God? Who cared more about the glory of God than Jesus Christ himself? We see that in his high priestly prayer in John 17. We saw also that David wasn't just a warrior king, though that was important, but he was also a shepherd king who shepherded the people of God. And Jesus Christ, of course, came initially as that shepherd king who will one day return as the warrior king. Because and Jesus, even as the shepherd king, he fought the enemies of God just as David did. But Jesus fought sin, fought Satan, fought all the enemies of God, and died doing it to procure victory, but then rose victoriously from the dead. It's no wonder then that the New Testament tells us of Jesus that one of his strongest bona fides, if you will, his credential, he's a son of David. But not just a son of David, he's the son of David, the predicted son, the one of whom God spoke when he said, "One day, David, you will have a son who will reign forever. We recognize Jesus because we read the story of David. David's not the Messiah, but he's so close that when we do see the real Messiah, we recognize him because he looks like David. Okay, well, and I did that right so I don't have to answer any of your questions.